My two cents is start divesting. If you haven't already divested, if you're running what I was running at like about 3 to 4 years ago, which is putting all your money into this washing machine, which is Google or Facebook or whatever, and seeing what comes out of it at the end of the day, that strategy is long gone.
We're on a mission. We're going to find and uncover the smartest, most successful entrepreneurs on the planet, explore their highs, their lows, and how they ultimately mastered the game. I'm Martin Cook, and I'm excited to welcome you to the Smarter Destiny podcast. I'm grateful for you and your time. Now let's level up together.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another Smarter Destiny podcast. Today we are joined by my friend Ronnie Tejar. He is on the show. He is the founder of Branzio Watches, an eight-figure, gorgeous watch company. Ronnie has figured out his market, which is young professionals looking for beautiful watches to wear with pride on their wrists. Ronnie is also a speaker and presenter at a bunch of online summits such as E-commerce World, Affiliate World Expo, and a host of others all over the world. And he is speaking predominantly around his skills of digital marketing, building real brands, advertising at excellence, and scaling massive remote teams. In the case of Branzio, we're talking about a team of 60 people all over the world, and going from 5 people to 60 very quickly, and then managing the chaos that would come from that. Ronnie's the man to learn from on this topic, and we're going to cover that and a lot more in today's show. But without further ado, let's welcome him to the stage. Ronnie, how's it going?
Hey, buddy. Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm stoked as well. I came across your brand, came across your LinkedIn, and I was just excited to have you on the show. I was like, this is the guy that our audience needs to hear from. So I'm absolutely delighted to have you on the show. Just days really before you're about to speak on stage in Dubai. I know you like to travel. Whereabouts in the world are you now, and whereabouts in the world are you normally?
So I'm right now speaking to you from the Maldives. So because I'm speaking in Dubai, like you mentioned, for a conference at which is Affiliate World, usually if the world was open, I cycle my time between Vancouver, Berlin, and Bangkok. So Bangkok's my home for about 6 to 7 months of the year. And then I spend a couple of months in Berlin and about a few months in Vancouver. So I'm a perpetual sun chaser.
Perpetual sun chaser. Except Berlin. That's I suppose they get a couple of months of sun, a bit like
that's pretty much it. That's when I'm there.
You're there for that little sun bit. Cool. All right. Well, so the way we like to kick these things off, Ronnie, is we like to go back. We like to go back to a sort of logical starting point in your story whereby you realized you're a little bit different to the rest of the world. You realized that you had entrepreneur muscles that other people don't have. You have challenges and visions and things that only seem to happen to entrepreneurs. And at some point in your early story, you discovered that in a tangible way, shall we say. It's your origin story. Something might have happened. If you've got a story in mind, could you take us back then and paint us a word picture?
Oh, yeah. So I can paint you that picture quite clearly. So a bit about myself. I'm a failed PhD, and of all the things is poverty economics. So at one point in time, I wanted to do good for the world and work for the World Bank or the IMF. My family got the golden ticket, which is an immigration application to Canada when I was living in the UK for a bit. And one of my first jobs when I moved to Canada, it was actually the first job, which was on May the 15th, which was the next day after I had landed, was actually going to pick blueberries in a farm.
Blueberry picking and job.
Yeah, it was a kicking job, man. And I had no idea, because I'd never done manual labor in my life before. So I was about, I think, 21 or 22. And I used to go and pluck and trust me, it broke me. It broke every shred of my ego, because, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I was studying at London School of Economics. And, you know, the next week, I'm basically picking blueberries in, you know, Vancouver, BC at some other guy's farm. Getting up at 5 a.m. to pick blueberries. And, you know, that whole experience broke me. And I remember working for 8-10 hours and making about $50 Canadian a day. And I promised myself back then, I was like, I'd never, ever, ever do this. So usually after that, I would take jobs or take opportunities where I would have the opportunity to sort of make my own paycheck, which was like the sales job or something, or, you know, be in control of my own destiny. Let's say I had more control over my life, so to say.
And so what was that? You had the realization. What did that lead into? What did you do?
Yeah. So from there on out, it's quite kind of an interesting story. I mean, I taught myself digital marketing. I like watched a bunch of YouTube videos, I didn't even take any courses. I didn't even read like what every entrepreneur or digital marketer says. I read the 4-hour work week and then I started my own business. I have not read the 4-hour work week ever in my life, and nor do I intend to read it. Essentially, I took a job in sales selling Punjabi radio door to door in a language that I didn't even speak. So although I'm Sikh, my dad was in the army, so I primarily spoke Hindi. So I taught myself how to speak Punjabi at the ripe age of 22, 23, and basically went door to door on a public transit system to the Indian part of town, literally going knocking door to door selling Indian radio, saying, hey, do you want to buy a radio space? And back then it was nascent and people said, what the hell is this guy on about? Anyway, we crushed about $500,000 in sales in the first year that I did it. So it was kind of interesting because I didn't have enough money to afford a car, man. So I used to take, I think it was my traveling expense was $5 a day. So I used to literally try and milk it as much as possible to be able to do that. And from there on, of course, taught myself digital marketing, got a job working for HSBC, where I was the head of retail banking for digital marketing, because it was still like a new thing back in like 2009, 2010. And people were like, what is this digital marketing? We'll hire this young buck and we'll pay him the lowest salary possible. You know, Johnson, back to the boiler room you go. And basically that was me. I got my first sort of, HSBC, for lack of a better word, I was working for a financial institution. And I literally got myself laid off from that job about 8 months in because I hated it. And I'll say this again to anybody, even including HSBC, if anybody listens to it from there, because I literally had to plan a campaign, a digital marketing campaign, 6 months before the execution of it. And I'm like, this is not how digital marketing works. We're supposed to be like lean. We're supposed to be fast. You know, if something happens in the morning, you can deploy it by the evening. That's how I worked. So my next job as a result of that, which was me sort of controlling my career path, was to go work at Best Buy, because Best Buy, you know, retail. Best Buy knows retail in and out. So that was the kind of place which was super interesting to me. Campaigns, there was about 10 campaigns dropping on me every morning for search, for display. So I was a media buyer, right? That's where I broke into media buying. And I was like, wait a second, this is awesome. And, you know, Samsung is running this promo, Apple's running that promo, you know, Valentine's is coming up and so wants a BOGO offer on their products. And I'm like, this is amazing. So that's what I would say I bit my teeth into, like, say, retail advertising, understand the D2C market a lot better. And so I worked there for about a year and a half. And then I said, look, I've learned a bit about it, about digital marketing. I won't say I knew everything, but I learned a fair share. And then I sort of packed my bags and moved to Australia. So where my clients were Target, Coles, and Bunnings, working for a digital marketing agency there. And that it was interesting, you know, it was an interesting experience. And then, you know, about 6 months into that job, I said, look, I'm not really having fun, because at the end of the day, I'm still working for someone. And that experience isn't that where I wanted to be. And I was getting close to, like, say, 30, 31, and having a midlife crisis, so to say, right? And moved from there, came back to Vancouver, worked at a small e-commerce firm for a year. And then I said, look, if I continue down this path, I'm going to end up working for somebody all the time. So at some point in time, I said, look, what is the one thing I've always wanted to do? It's like, I owe it to myself at a certain point of time to take that chance on myself. And I had just turned 30 and I said, look, this is it, right? If I don't do it now, and if I don't put all my life savings into this one venture that I know of, then I'm going to fail. And, you know, lo and behold, my first sort of venture was starting an ad agency, because that's the only thing I knew how to do, which was like a media buying agency, right? Had a couple of clients. And then again, at the end of the day, you know, about 3 months in, I realized, what am I doing here? I'm still at somebody else's beck and call. I'm not in charge of my own destiny, because at the end of the day, my revenues are tied to somebody else. And then after that, I said, look, this is enough. I read somewhere that the margins on watches are extremely high. It's just some online article that I read. So I started getting into watches. And I said, look, and there was a big boom of like these indie watch companies, you know, Movement or Kimono and, you know, Bamboo, tree watches and all that kind of stuff, which was super, super interesting for me. And I said, look, let's have a go and see how we go from there. So the first 3 months of Brandzeer, I made all the mistakes possible that you could when starting an e-commerce company, getting the molds made in China, dealing with trading companies, dealing with, not dealing with IP infringement, et cetera, et cetera. So about 3 months in, our watch is ready. We have these sexy, sleek designs all ready to deploy. You know, I've put about $10,000 of a watch order, which is basically 50% of what I had saved up. And the day before we are supposed to launch, guess what happens? Somebody in Vancouver, who I don't know about, has a Kickstarter campaign going on with the same damn logo, with the same damn watch straps, and the same damn watch boxes that we have. And I'm like, holy hell, what do we do? So all the work that you've done for the last 3 months basically goes straight down the drain. And at this point in time, I probably have another $6,000-$7,000 left in the bank account, which isn't enough to hire a designer, isn't enough to put in the next big order or anything else. So I thought like my e-commerce venture had basically failed even before I'd started it. And so then I read again somewhere that the world's largest watch expo in the world happens in Hong Kong. And I said, wait a second, Vancouver to Hong Kong is how much? It's basically like a $800 flight return. And I said, okay, let's go to ground zero. Took a one-way ticket to Hong Kong. I said, I'm not coming back till the time I find a way to get back home. Stayed, you basically landed up to my buddy's house who lives there. And I said, I'm camping with you till I figure this out. So luckily that sort of helped me out in terms of not spending too much money. But every day at the watch fair, people hated me because I would literally go and ask them 10, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 different questions. And they were like, is this guy even going to do business with us? Or he's just like, you know, is he just kicking tires? So at the end of it, I found one watch supplier who was small enough to take a chance on me. So these watch suppliers were in Shenzhen, which is across from Hong Kong, as most people know. Ended up going to this guy's house. Again, asked him, can I live with you, please? Because I wanted to save money. I was out Indianing everybody at that point in time. And basically, the guy says, come on in, I've got a guest room. Hung out with his family, hung out with grandparents. Went every day for the watch factory with them for like, I think about a couple of weeks. And at the end of the day, convinced him. And you know, to this day, I'm super grateful for that opportunity, which is basically he extended me a 60-day line of credit when I started. He didn't take the money up front. He says, I'll take a bet on you. And that bet's worked out for me to today. So every time I do get a chance, I will thank this watch supplier because they took a chance when I needed the most. And of course, it's worked out for both of us in the long run because we have grown to a sizable business. About, you know, 8 figures plus, and the watch factory has grown with us. So it's a collaborative growth. And but at the same time, I won't take away from the fact that I was lucky that I found such a watch supplier that decided to take that that risk on a budding young entrepreneur. So yeah, so here we are. So about 6 years later. Yeah, 6 years later, and then it's been a wild ride. You know what I mean? It's like I've made really bad hiring decisions. I've been through ups and downs in terms of, you know, your account getting banned on Facebook, on Google, on PayPal, all this other BS. You know, and these are things that I think every entrepreneur has been through, which is basically, you know, you've had that sort of resilience story. You've had the story of going against all odds. But, you know, I would say to this day, the timing of it and a little bit of luck has played a large part in how we've ended up here.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's almost like a cliche. I imagine a lot of entrepreneurs right now sort of like almost they're like, oh, do you remember the times where our only problems were getting banned by Facebook, getting a payment hold on PayPal, getting, you know, all of the rest of the stuff. Whereas, you know, now it's like, oh, do you remember the time before iOS 14 challenges? Do you remember the time before Facebook, now Meta, wasn't distracted by creating a freaking 3D universe, forgetting who's paying their bills in the advertisers,
exactly.
Right? And then, you know, but, you know, we'll get into that. So this was January 2015, you scale. It's incredible that, you know, by the power there of face-to-face contact with this supplier and building a relationship and how that is manifested to today. You've obviously grown, and you know, I'm not going to dwell too much on the. In this case, I'm not going to dwell too much on the early days because 2015, I think, with e-commerce brands, it was different, right? It was different. Cheap CPMs. You can almost throw anything out there, and it was a lot easier than just Facebook to Facebook. It was a lot easier, but of course, there's always new ad platforms coming out and so on. I'd like to talk about. Like now, more like present day. So we're in 2022. Mm-hmm. And where does the if you're able to talk about the kind of spend across the board that you're spending on media, great. If you don't want to, that's also fine. But at least where does the percentage split go? Like what percentage of traffic is Facebook, Google, TikTok, WhatsApp, whatever? Right now.
Yeah, I mean, look, just to give you a background, so Brandzio itself has a portfolio of about 15 different websites. Right. So our strategy, let's say, because I saw how much. So about 3 years ago, our total percentage of ad spend compared to the company revenue was at 50%, which is a big red flag in general. Right. It's a massive red flag that you're so platform dependent. And I keep saying platform dependency because this all of us by default are it's either Facebook, Apple, Google, the usual suspects, right? Amazon. And what I said was we need to take some measures where we actually are growing organic traffic, right? We're growing affiliate traffic through organic. We are divesting, we just want to divest the pot that we have. So essentially we took that 50% ad spend. We said, look, we'll use some of this money to start acquiring affiliate sites, right? So affiliate sites being content websites that we have partnered with who are driving affiliate revenue for us. What would it take to sort of buy these websites, looking at the revenue for the next 5 years? Number one. Number two, how can we build a solid SEO strategy to divest from paid traffic, create quality content, and divest from, let's say, paid PPC to Google SEO, right? For Facebook, believe it or not, for our brand has been pretty good, Instagram especially. But we said, look, at some point in time, when we started seeing declining revenues on Facebook about 2.5 years ago, we said, why don't we start working with influencers directly, right? Which everybody is doing now. So there was this proactivity from within the organization, people including myself, our marketing directors, and everybody else. And we said, look, we need to start divesting. And what that has done for us in the long run, right? TikTok for us hasn't really worked. I'll be super, super honest, because it does drive a lot of traffic, but that traffic isn't quality. And our product may not be what we want to be selling on TikTok, right? But we have been able to divest that pot from, say, 50% to, let's say, we've been able to reduce the ad spend to about, let's say, 25 to 30%. But we've been able to increase revenue from all these other sources that I've just mentioned as well. So divestment has been key for us. I don't want to be that guy say, look, I told you so, and blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. But what I can tell you is if you have, iOS 15 is going to hit, Google's already planning, their own little bubble, which is basically like taking, they'll only make you exist within the Google bubble or whatever for first party data, et cetera, which is going to affect advertisers again. My two cents is start divesting. If you haven't already divested, if you're running what I was running at like about 3 to 4 years ago, which is putting all your money into this washing machine, which is Google or Facebook or whatever, and seeing what comes out of it at the end of the day, that strategy is long gone. It's not 2015 or 2016. I think you need to start having a well thought out strategy for content. You need to have a well thought out strategy for influencers. And influencers have sort of worked out for us, where we've even taken within the influencer sphere, where we are divesting even from Instagram now. Because everybody's hitting up these Instagram influencers, and then we're moving it to YouTube. And I find YouTube is a lot better channel in terms of engagement for your brand, in terms of branding, in terms of the kind of influencers you're dealing with, because those influencers care more about their audience more than anything else. Whereas for Instagram, I feel like everybody's jumping on the Instagram bandwagon. Instagram is sort of like a narcissistic tool. I don't know if you'd agree with me on that. So you're basically feeding somebody's ego. And an influencer, 100,000 followers, has a big ego already. And you're approaching them and they're going to quote you, figures out of their ass. And I don't agree with that.
I think that's brilliant. So making this actionable for the listeners today. So we're convinced on divesting and putting less of our money into, as you said, the Facebook washing machine, which I love that, sort of bouncing around and whatever comes out. And so we're going to divest. You talked about buying and partnering with content sites that are around, I guess, your search terms or what people are searching in relation to your watches. How would you go about that now, like in this year, across different, not necessarily in watches, but for applying it generally for our audience, how would you go about finding those potentials, reaching out to them? What's the conversation like? How would you do that?
Sure. So I would give you like a normal example, right? It's like, let's take an example of something which is pretty niche down. Let's take an example of like a protein shake, right? So I'm a newbie to the gym. I don't know what the best protein powder I should be buying, right? I'll go to Google search and I'll say best protein powder review. So review terms. So look up very generic search terms. So it could be like best protein powder review, best mass gainer review, et cetera, right? From there on out, I would look at page one or page two of Google, make a list of all the sites within that, right? Some of those sites will carry their own protein powder, which is, you know, bodybuilding.com or muscleandtech.com or whatever. I don't know how I know this, but I know this. And then I would say, okay, these guys are carrying their own products. Maybe this is not the right fit. But you'll start seeing like some websites on there. And you're like, wait a second, there's these, let's say the bottom, let's say 70% or whatever on those page two results are not, they're not carrying any of that. And they're driving traffic directly to Amazon. Well, the reason why I would say it's quite important is if you look at the affiliate revenue that Amazon is driving, it's between like 2-3%. Whereas what you do is you basically go in with the same guys and saying, look, guys, these are my conversion rates. I'm converting at a bit lower conversion rate than Amazon, but the affiliate rate that I'm going to give you is going to be 10%, 12%, right? So I'm going to give you four times the amount that Amazon is going to give you. And in the long run, you show them the earnings of yourself versus Amazon. So you literally do the calculation and you take a, you know, you can just take like a generic protein powder, say on it or something on Amazon, and you can take your protein powder, look at the track of sales that the affiliate is going to make over the next 12 months, and just do a price comparison and show them. So it's dollars to dollars, cent to cents, what they want on Amazon versus your own protein powder building site. So once you see this in black and white, most affiliate guys are like, they're very smart guys, but they're very focused in. So they've got sort of blinders on in the sense that they're focused only on the SEO of it, right? They're only focused on building good content and they're focused on that audience and that niche in perspective. So dollars and cents is, you know, they'll just say, oh, I'll just build an affiliate site. We'll just promote Amazon products. That's the best way to monetize it, right? But now what you're doing is affiliates also need to sort of have this mix. Like I was talking about platform dependency for e-commerce sites. Affiliates are also looking at, you know, that sort of mix of having direct advertisers, having display ads, having Amazon, having everything, which increases their website value at the end of the day when they want to have an exit. So we want to have that sort of the that game in play with them.
Beautiful. Okay, so we've done our research and we've identified the potential contenders and we've reached out to them. We've done that sort of price comparison, if you like, of what they're getting with Amazon, what they would get with you. How do you then begin to structure the deal and set up tracking so that they're comfortable that it's accurate, you know, all of that good stuff?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things, right? So there's a couple of Shopify apps that you can use that I can recommend. Like, I'm not getting affiliate out of this. Refersion is a good one. You can use that to track affiliate revenue. If you want to do it cheap and cheerful, the way I do it, I basically have a massive list of Excel sheets, like a massive Excel sheet for influencers, for SEO, for review, for SEO websites, affiliate websites, or whatever, right? Everything has a UTM tracker, which you can literally just Google, you know, append UTM tracking code, and literally just give them the UTM tracking code they have. You give each website that you're working with a unique promo code. So you literally have, let's say, 400 rows with each promo code. And in the back end in Shopify, you can actually go and filter and look up the promo code as to how much each of these affiliates are driving for you, be it an influencer, be it a YouTube guy, be it a affiliate guy. And then you can actually show them, send them the screenshot from Shopify for the last 30 days for the sales they made. We usually have a window when we pay them out, which is usually between 15 to 20 days, because in some cases from the mistakes that I made, which I hope you don't make, is that you don't pay them immediately after the sale. So you can set those terms up front with the affiliates, pretty much, right? It's like, look, we'll pay you for the order. There's no issues here. I just need 15 days to pass because by then the customer has the product. They, you know, the return guarantee would have been passed and then we'll give you the money. No problems.
Beautiful. So, and that's...
You want to bake in your return policy into that contract.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, so we're finding these people, and at the same time, you've got your own SEO strategy in place, your sort of internal SEO, right? So you're creating content around around watches that is owned content. Do you ever merge the two and strike deals with the people who are already providing content as traffic from their content as affiliates and say, hey, can I buy your site? I think you said that earlier on.
That's exactly what we do. So if we start seeing that some of these content websites they're scaling and they're doing really really well, then we're like, wait a second, what would it take to buy this? So the question I ask myself is, how much money is this one website going to generate for us in the next 5 years? Does it make sense to just go ahead, give them a lump sum upfront and just acquire the website? And if you give them the lump sum upfront, what say if you were to give them $100,000, right? And you just go to the guy and say, look, I'll tell you what, I'm going to give you 60 grand upfront cash to acquire a website. Most people would say yes, because I'll take the money now, right? Nobody, not a lot of people think about year 2, 3, 4, 5, because Google's going to do an algo change. Google's going to do that. Then I will assume that risk for you. Mm-hmm. So that's how I would think about it. And in some cases, what we do is we'll have an earnout period for the person who owns the website, right? So what we do is essentially we'll keep them on for a couple of years. In 2 years, we're going to pay them out with the money they would have given to us, essentially, right? And then basically acquire a website on the site at a steep discount.
Beautiful, absolutely beautiful. Okay, so you've got these deals set up, and so earlier on we were talking about like your traffic mix, so the sort of percentage of traffic that's now coming in to your brand. What sort of, where do you estimate the kind of slices of traffic nowadays in 2022?
We are very Google dependent, man. I've moved all my chips to Google. Like I'll be super honest with you, it's mostly Google and affiliates.
Google search, Google shopping, influencers
would be included in affiliate sites. Yes. Facebook, we've scaled back. Facebook ad spend has been scaled back, I would say, literally by 80%.
What about, so Google, so are you talking display, search?
Google YouTube? Search, display, YouTube. So I would say about 25% of our total ad budget goes to Google, right? And the rest, we will test. So we will test TikTok, we will test Snapchat, we will test, all the other platforms. We usually keep an 80-20 rule, which is basically 20%. We'll always go and do something silly with it. That's a bet we're willing to take over, which is basically to say, look, can we go ahead and just lose this money? Do we have money to spend? Of course, in a measured way. Please don't take me at that, at face value saying, oh, I'm just going to throw away 10 grand, but it's like, it's measured. So it's like, okay, are we going to bet on TikTok? Are we going to put a $10,000 bet on TikTok? What are the CPMs on TikTok? So sometimes what we will do is we'll take the average CPM for what our customers would pay on, say, YouTube, right? And we'll take it across the influencer platforms and we'll say, if it's a $5 CPM, cost per thousand, then what can we get for a $5 CPM on TikTok, right? And if it's triple the audience, then we say, okay, how about we just get more eyeballs so that, at the end of the day, more people are exposed to the brand, then we'll actually track it, let's say 3 weeks later and see if there's a brand impression share increase on Google. So how much do a mother brand searches actually trigger after we've run this campaign for a couple of weeks?
I love that.
So it's not just, so what a lot of people I think do, and what I would encourage people to think about from a graduation perspective is most people are looking at performance marketing, right? I'm going to put a dollar into the washing machine. I want $2 back today, right? Fair enough. I agree. That's how the world used to run a few years ago. Now, everybody talks about brand building. Everybody talks about, how are you going to reach my eyeballs? Brand is built by reaching eyeballs, goddammit. So the thing is, the more people that see you, like Coke didn't become Coke, or Pepsi didn't become Pepsi overnight. They literally ran the Super Bowl ads. They ran, all these fancy ads, with the polar bear or the Christmas or with the Grand Theft Auto. And that's embedded in the back of your mind. They've been consistently putting this stuff in front of you for the last 50 years. And what people want to do is they want to start an e-commerce dropshipping store and they expect you to become a Coke tomorrow. It's not going to work like that. I mean, what you got to do is you got to think about, of course, in your nascent days, performance marketing is the way to go. You're going to hit a break. Then you're going to go to from 100 to $1 million store. From a 1 to 5 million is extremely hard. For that next level, you need to, look at all divesting your traffic, investing in affiliates and influencers and everything else. And then you go from the 5 to $15 million mark, which is basically you want to grow as quickly as possible by getting in front of as many eyeballs. Once you hit 50 million, that's when you become a brand in e-commerce, a pure D2C brand. And at $50 million, your valuation is 1x of your gross if you ever want to sell, which is basically you would exit for $50 million because you've become a brand.
See, I've actually heard of multiples much higher than that at the moment, and particularly when you start factoring in things like offline retail, having large communities like VIP groups, things like
subscriptions.
That.
Yeah, all these different things, but I'm just talking about, you know, your exit value that used to be 2 to 3x, you know, post-pandemic isn't 2 to 3x, it's about 6-7x. But you still have to like think about it from a long-term perspective, right?
Absolutely.
The long-term perspective of what we're looking at is to grow that brand, right? That brand that needs to grow to a $50 million mark is extremely, extremely important to reach that.
Where can people find out more about Brandzeo?
So you can reach us directly on our website, brandzeo.com. That's where we sell our watches, and that's a pretty good way to actually look at it. So if you're in the market for a men's watch company, you know, brandzeo.com is the way to go.
Check it out. They look great, folks. Brandzeo.com. Have a look. There's some nice, I'm looking at them now, there's some nice designs on there that you absolutely need to wear on your wrist. So, Ronnie, at this point in the show, we like to mix it up. We go into the rapid fire question round. I ask the questions quickly, and you can choose the speed in which you want to answer. Are you up for that?
Okay, I'm ready, man. Let's go.
Are you two thumbs up for that?
Oh, yes. Two thumbs
there
up, buddy.
There's the thumbs. All right, question number one. If you ever had to start again, and I know you have had to start again a few times, how would you make your money?
I'd probably be a consultant. I'd probably be a digital media consultant or something like that.
Yeah?
Yeah, cool. I think that would be it. I think if you were to give me anything, what would I? Yeah, it would be like a consultant, basically. Because I think it's like you're using experiences and knowledge to be able to give back. But I, you know, at the same time, if you were to give me a blank piece of paper, maybe I'd go back and finish my PhD in poverty economics. Because I still have that feeling of, you know, I missed out on not completing my PhD.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an unfinished rule. It's an unfinished business, man. So I got to finish it.
What's the most common or biggest mistake leaders make?
Being not listening. I think a lot of people just love talking about themselves. They never take the time to listen to somebody else. You can learn a lot by listening to people, I think.
Beautiful. Who is a great leader, alive or dead, and why?
I would say, for me, personally speaking, it would probably be my mom. My mom is 60. She completed her master's at the age of 55. At 62, she's starting her PhD. Wow. She single-handedly raised us as kids. And, you know, and on top of all that, she runs a full-time business as a counselor. And she's doing all this on the side. So I'd say, yeah, for me, it's my mom. I don't need to look too far away at Elon Musk or anybody else. I think that lady does enough.
Nice. How do you evaluate a good business deal?
That's a hard one, man. It's always about the dollars and cents. It's always going to be about the dollars and cents. You have to have a long-term value associated with it, right? Your long-term value could be the business assets you are willing to acquire, in terms of HR, in terms of anything else, or what are the long-term values in terms of 5, 10, 15 years from now where you see things going on. So, you know, of course, there's soft skills behind it, like, you know, what is the team that you're coming in, et cetera, et cetera. But for me, I think personally speaking, it always has come down to dollars and cents. So in 5 years' time, where's the business going? And is this a strategic fit? Like, for example, when we tend to hire employees, I always think culture first, because our culture for our company is so, so goddamn important. So like, even if you acquire businesses, that's a soft side I would look at is, would this person fit in well with our culture? If they don't, unfortunately, we passed on a lot of deals because of that. Yeah.
Nice. What is one of your proudest moments?
My proudest moment is when I made my first sale. I'm not really going to lie, man. I'm not even going to goddamn lie. It was the first time I heard that ding of that sale. It was January the 2nd, the day after I launched my website. It was Margaret something in Australia who bought my first, you know, my first watch.
Amazing. Yeah. What's one interesting fact about you that not many people would know?
Oh, I'm an avid squash player. I've played squash for the last 10 years.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I'm not that good, but I consider myself to be decent.
That's the thing with squash, though. It's better to play, particularly for fitness, it's better to play someone who's better than you than worse than you. Like, you get a way better game, right?
So. You're right.
What daily routines do you have, whether morning or evening, that have helped make you more successful?
Waking up at 5 a.m., right? I don't know if you like your coffee, but I personally love my coffee. So I spend the first 10 minutes making like filter coffee. So I've got my own filter coffee set, and it's a slow pour, so it gives me enough time, you know, to think about things. And then I work in the morning for about 2.5 hours, then I go to the gym. So always wake up early by 8 o'clock. My like literally by 8 o'clock, most of my morning thinking is done. And then I'll catch up on I'm mostly likely by inbox zero by 9 a.m. So, and then my workday starts.
Nice.
Yeah.
What book or books changed your mindset or life?
That's an interesting one. Ogilvy and Advertising. I read it when I was 14. I wanted to get into advertising when I read that. Blood, Brains, and Beer, David Ogilvy. That's another one.
What was that second one?
Blood, Brains, and Beer.
Blood, Brains, and Beer. I've not heard that one
before. Same guy, David Ogilvy. He's a charismatic fella. He's a very charismatic fellow if you like advertising. Scientific Advertising by Claude Hopkins. That's a big one for me. And, you know, along the way, a few of the Elon Musk type books, you know, Ashley Vance, that most startup guys would say. But the core of where I was at 14, if you haven't read Confessions of an Advertising Man or Ogilvy on Advertising, I think you're missing out on a lot of the grounds of how humans think or how advertising actually works. That book was written about 70 years ago. And there's this quote I can still remind you of. Well, I still remember from that book, or the drop of a hat, which is basically like, humans haven't changed for a millennia, right? The basic needs have always been the same, which is, you know, food, shelter, community. Those three things will always be with humans for no matter how long we've lived. And I can quote it like the back of my hand, yeah. So
nice.
Yeah, impactful.
It is impactful. What's the most exciting question you spend your time thinking about?
It's growth. So I'm lucky that I have so many people to help support me. I mean, I have the opportunity that in the day to day of my business, there's other people who actually stepped in and taken over for me. So no matter how big I play myself or whatever, there's other people who are actually doing work behind the scenes. So my biggest sort of focus on my mind, which I get free time for, is how to grow the business. How do I become a brand? How do I get recognized? How do I get in front of as many customers as possible, which I was talking about earlier, is like, how do we get in front of so many eyeballs that we actually end up becoming this force of nature? That is what, you know, bothers me or keeps me up at night, is like, how can we scale to a $50 or $60 million company?
Where do you think those eyeballs are going to come from next for you?
If I knew, I wouldn't tell you. I'm joking. I think, you know, stick to it. I don't know. I wish I had known. If I had known, then, you know, we'll be a $50, $60 million company, fortunately, then.
Nice. What was your biggest challenge starting in business, and how did you overcome it?
Biggest challenge was getting a PayPal account shut down within 2 months of starting, and then taking away half our money for 6 months. That was the third or fourth time in my life I went down to $0 in the bank account, man. Then I had to take another loan from the bank. So yeah, I've seen that $0 bank account a few times. Oof.
What unusual or underrated food or drink should more people try out?
Oh, you know what? I'll suggest you some Indian food if you like. You're British, so you love that. So a good aloo paratha, which is basically the stuffed Indian bread with potatoes in it, with butter and Indian style scrambled eggs. It's called Anda Bhujia. Try it out, man. It's definitely the best hangover food you'll ever have. I don't drink anymore, but it's the thing. If you come to my mother's house, if she makes you that, that means she loves you a lot.
Nice. Bear that in mind. And the final question, Ronnie, what makes you happiest?
I think I've been lucky that at the moment that I have everything around me, a successful business, a loving family, and a great girlfriend, right? So if people were to say, what more do you want? I don't want anything else. I'm very contented with what I have. I have enough to provide for those around me. And I hate to say it, but, you know, my level of contentment where I am is I'm the happiest I've ever been in my life.
Beautiful. So what makes you happiest right now? Just life.
Right now, man. Yeah. Just sitting in the Maldives, going diving in the morning, doing interviews with Martin in the evening, and then have, you know, smashing a couple of hours of work after. This is it.
Living the dream. That's amazing. I love that. I love that answer. I don't think we've had that sort of answer, like, just right now. I don't think we've necessarily had that answer on the show. So it's a first after 150 plus episodes.
Thank you.
Ronnie, it's been an absolute pleasure. I really like the way you think. I really like the way you look, the lens you see things through. I'm loving that you delved into the SEO strategy, making it super actionable for the audience today. It's been a tremendously valuable interview, valuable episode. I love what you're doing. Thank you so much for taking the time and spending it with me and us on the show today.
Thank you so much, man. It's been nothing but a pleasure, and I look forward to taking you to your first cricket game in the IPL soon, buddy.
Hey there, you incredibly good-looking human. Thanks so much for listening. If you had a good time today and would like more good times in the future, please hit that subscribe button and leave a heartwarming review. I read them all, and it will go a long way to help others out there benefit from all the teachings of this show. And if you want to get in touch or otherwise learn more about me, head to martincook.co.uk or smarterdestiny.com. I really appreciate you. You're an incredible human. Until next time, keep crushing.